today. Questions of identity in one of the most marginal seats in the country. And the heavy price one journalist paid for press freedom in Turkey. Rob, why did you go to Peterborough?
We went there because it was one of the most marginal seats in the country, and it's a fascinating place because it's been affected by austerity, it's been affected by immigration, it's keen on Brexit, and yet it seems very confused about where it wants to go, and the politics of the place has been very up and down over the last few years with different parties taking control of the place, and it seemed to be the kind of place that sort of sums up where this election's at.
The Guardian social affairs correspondent, Rob Booth, has spent this year returning time and again to Peterborough to report on housing, politics, and the increasingly insecure world of work. It's an interesting constituency. Peterborough voted 61% in favour of Brexit and then booted out a Brexiteer Tory. Constituents then sacked a Labour MP following a criminal conviction. Jeremy Corbyn's party held the seat in a by-election, but is now facing a fierce fight against the Conservatives and the Brexit Party who topped the polls in European elections. All this in a place that just 2 months ago lost one of its flagship employers, Thomas Cook, and with it more than 1,000 local jobs. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, a 40-year story of shifting political identity.
Thomas Cook moved to Peterborough in 1977, which was a time that Peterborough was expanding really rapidly as part of the third wave of new towns.
In 1960, there were 3 billion people in the world. By 1985, barring accidents, there'll be 5 billion. If chaos is to be avoided, homes and opportunities must be organised for them now. This time, the authorities of Peterborough have already seen the light. By 1985, enough homes, opportunities and facilities befitting a civilised way of life for an extra 100,000 people are to be built here.
I mean, the New Town projects throughout the 20th century produced some places that were kind of visionary, and Peterborough was no different. It's an old medieval city with a tremendous medieval cathedral at the heart of it. So what they decided to do was build these townships, grand estates really, and they were built to be very kind of homely, humane places, council housing. The population expanded very rapidly and lots of people from London moved there, and there were plenty of jobs, and it was a kind of hopeful time.
Do you think that the new Peterborough is going to be a better place to live in than the present Peterborough?
Very much better. I'm quite sure about this for a number of reasons. First, there'll be many, many more job opportunities and career opportunities than there are here now. 50,000 people work here now. At the end of expansion, it'll be 100,000 jobs. There'll be a much bigger and better range of shops, many more opportunities for leisure, more schools, better schools, one would hope, more opportunities for
And the arrival of this flagship, iconic British company, Thomas Cook, was part of the expansion.
So for the last 40 years, its headquarters has been, you know, a central part of the economy. Everybody knows someone who works there, whether a family member or a friend, over 1,000 people employed in the office of, everyone calls it Cook's. And it was the kind of place that the people took a huge amount of pride in, a very outward-looking company, offered people lots of travel opportunities to get around the world. And it was a sort of emotional company to work for because the customers were having the times of their lives, and the people who worked for it felt very proud to be involved with that.
At this time of year, people all over the country are planning their next holiday.
I got them! I got them!
Okay, now I've all made up our minds exactly what we want.
Powerboat, swimming! Sandy beaches is horse riding!
So let's put it in writing. My mum, she'd make it neat. She's taking us to Thomas Cook this afternoon.
Swimming, hamburgers, sea fishing, fun fairs.
Yeah. Don't just book it, Thomas Cook it.
Our mantra at that place was customer at our heart, and that was really true.
Yeah.
Really, really true. You know, we lived and breathed that place, and a lot of us did, you know, for so many years. It's like most of my working life I spent there.
So that's Emily Chappell, and the sense of joy she had about working at Thomas Cook was something I picked up from lots of people, including Nicola Cathell, who welled up when we were talking.
I think Thomas Cook is more than just a job. It's the people that you meet along the way. They become your best friends, really. You spend so much time with people whilst you're there. I'm getting all emotional. What's wrong with me?
Thomas Cook had been in Peterborough for more than 40 years, an integral part of the city, contributing to its wealth. But then that began to shift with warning signs about the health of the company.
We're seeing some pretty big losses from Thomas Cook today, down more than 39%. The company has really been struggling to pay down a lot of their debt, but the reason...
And it all came to a head in one week in September.
So I was doing 12, 14-hour days in those last 3 days up to the collapse. I was on a crisis team, and it was getting more evident that this is getting really serious, this is getting really close to... something quite worrying.
Emily had been working there for 15 years, and as the company was struggling, she was one of the people in the office trying to reassure customers who'd spent all their money on holidays that they would be okay.
I was trying to reply to the questions, saying, really sorry, I've kept you waiting for so long. You know, we were getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages a minute. Obviously my daughter saw me sort of quite distressed and upset, because at that time I was thinking, why isn't this going away? Why, you know, all the bosses, you know, sort of hiding away, which is what it felt like. So your fears
were sort of growing. Things weren't looking very good, and she was awake, as lots of the Thomas Cook staff were, in the middle of the night on a Sunday night, and the email finally came through that she'd been dreading, which was that the company had collapsed. And she recalled that moment, and it was something that was quite devastating for her.
The rest of the family, you know, they went to sleep, and I was stayed up and up. And then I was looking and looking, and, 2 minutes past two, the BBC app announces it. And that's when, I messaged my, sort of friend and said, that's it, it's over. It was like a bereavement, because it was our life. Not once did I go in that place thinking, I don't want to be there. I love that job. I know what bereavement is. I've lost my mum and my dad.
What I was going to say.
And it's like your identity is being ripped away. And my other half has said, he said to me, "Oh, don't worry, you'll get another job." But it's not quite as simple as that.
Wow. When you think of the reporting, a lot of it was about stricken holidaymakers, but it was terrible for the staff. How did Peterborough respond?
When Thomas Cook went down, the town really rallied round, and it continues to rally round, and the sense of people helping each other is something that people in Peterborough are very proud of.
It was amazingly overwhelming, you know, all the kind generosity, and I know people like to have their say about Peterborough and how rubbish it is and what a horrible place, but there's businesses that, you know, came out straight out, you know, and you know, offer their help.
You know, taxi drivers offering lifts and people looking out for each other. And there's a big kind of leaving party being organised. The local arena has offered a place where they'll be able to celebrate, if you like, or come together and remember their time together at Thomas Cook. So that, you know, there is a kind of sense of solidarity in the place.
Why did Thomas Cook go bust?
Complicated story. Part of it was to do with the fact that the company was trying to buy more and more high street shops at a time when people were moving on to buying holidays on the internet. Another part of it was to do with the fact that they were using huge amounts of debt to do that they couldn't really cope with. And then, of course, you know, the chief executives and the top brass of the company were taking home really big salaries, so that didn't help keep costs down.
This all happened just 2 months ago, and now we're in the middle of a general election campaign. Did people link this to politics?
I did ask people that, and to be honest, they said no. It wasn't really that they were thinking of the two things at the same time. But the more people spoke about different aspects of politics and their lives, the two things started to coincide, and that kind of level of distrust they felt in both groups was something that came out.
I hate all politicians.
Right.
I think they're all a bunch of liars. So yeah, I think, you know, they're all in it. It's like the CEO of our company. They're in it for their own gains. I don't see anyone looking down at the good people that are trying to go out to work and support the families.
We sort of report on a story like that and we move on. But it sounds from what you're telling me that its identity was entwined with Peterborough and that it going under really upset people because a lot of their pride was wrapped up in that company. I mean, what does it mean that it's gone?
It's that sort of intangible sense of identity that glues towns and cities together in our country. And when that glue starts to come apart, other problems are exposed. And the other thing to say, I think, is that the Thomas Cook story hasn't finished. As people's redundancy pay unwinds, this is going to be having an effect on the town and the families who live there for months to come. One of the consequences of the collapse of Thomas Cook is that it's exposed people to a different kind of an economy, a different kind of work.
I mean, personally, I've probably applied for around 50 jobs just on places like LinkedIn and various different agencies, and you just don't hear back. So, you know, when you don't hear back from them, it's just a little bit soul-destroying, really. But financially, with it coming to Christmas, a lot of people with young children, it is going to be a very difficult situation if you've not got a job. Some people, to be fair, have taken on temporary roles, doing zero-hour contracts just to get money in as well.
What sort of places?
I mean, I think a couple of people that I know, one's working at Showcase Cinema, doing a zero-hour contract just to get money in, just to make sure that they can cover their bills and things. There was someone else is going to work in a bowling alley, just to make sure that they can support their family, really.
And they were people who were previously doing kind of stable...
Yeah, stable, good jobs that have probably been in them for quite some time.
People talking about being willing to do, you know, the most basic work in order to keep the mortgage payments and the rent payments in place. And obviously, you know, there is a concern at the back of people's minds that, you know, they're only a couple of rent payments away from homelessness themselves.
But I think, you know, Peterborough itself is... I'm not quite sure how to word this, but, you know, there's a lot of homeless people. You know, there's lots of people every time, we were talking earlier about it, weren't we, that every time you go into town, even walking up the main street, you could probably try to be stopped by three or four people just from one street. And it's, you know, it is a difficult place to be. Hopefully none of our colleagues will end up in that situation, but it's not a very rich town anyway.
It seems like a kind of distant prospect in some ways, but people are aware that there isn't much of a safety net if you don't have a salary and can't get another job. Some people are getting other jobs in the travel industry and travelling around, but one of the things that people in Peterborough can't avoid is the amount of rough sleeping. And so it is in the minds of some of those people at Thomas Cook that that's really something that they want to keep well clear of.
Can't avoid it because as you were walking around, you saw it everywhere.
Well, there's a huge amount of begging in the town centre from homeless people. Down by the river, you'll start to see in the trees and in the bushes tents where people are sleeping. When I was there, the river had flooded some of the tents.
Do you have any sense of how widespread homelessness is there?
2,355 people presented themselves to the local authorities homeless, and they're really struggling to deal with it. It went up 50% last year. People in Peterborough find it really hard to swallow. It's one of the top issues for people when you ask them about what matters in this election. Seeing this homelessness is painful for them, and yet they don't really know what they can do about it.
And it's not like rough sleeping is only taking place in Peterborough. I mean, unfortunately, it's something that we see more of all over the country. I guess there's a real irony, isn't there, in the idea that a place famous for building new homes has ended up with such visible rough sleeping.
That's right. I went to a homeless day centre, which turns into a makeshift barber's on a Monday, and I met this lovely, gentle guy, Paul.
Hello, Paul.
Are you all right?
You're cutting your hair?
He's kind of lived that entire story because his family arrived in Peterborough at the beginning of the new town construction, and his father worked on the housing corporations that were building those estates.
That's how I'm in Peterborough. My parents moved here. My father worked on the development corporation, which everybody got housed. You know, people moved up from London to fill the houses because there was lots of houses. But I guess times change, don't they? They're just too many people and not enough properties.
Now he has found himself homeless himself. He's in temporary accommodation. He's been on a housing waiting list for almost a year. He had to spend some time sleeping in his car.
Well, I'm waiting for property to become available in social housing. So that you get a bidding number and you bid, but there's thousands of people waiting for the same place. There is private rental market, but the private rental market for people who aren't working is a difficult minefield, really. Apart from there not being too many available, the deposit schemes, then the guarantor schemes make it pretty much impossible to get hold of a private rental. Very unaffordable. Yeah, it's, 80% of your budget, really. So, it's terrible.
What difference would it make to your life to have a home?
Oh, massive difference. I can ease the burden with my ex-partner and I can have the kids over to give her free time and, I can buy things that I need for my life. Simple things like washing machines and, bits and pieces that everybody just takes for granted. But when you're in temporary accommodation, there is nowhere to put these objects. It's a box. You live in a box and then you wait for that box to be moved into a home. So, build more social housing. There needs to be, like the old development corporation, a big influx of social housing to be built. Without that, it's only adding to the problem.
So is he supporting Labour then? I mean, they've got big plans for building council homes.
Well, you'd think that would be, attractive to him. But, like many people in Peterborough, he has lost any kind of sense of trust in politics. He says he never votes.
We're led to believe that our vote could count, but does it really count? I don't think it does. People vote for one thing. It doesn't happen. People feel let down by their vote, don't they?
You think about Brexit when you say that?
I didn't say that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The majority voted, either side, whichever way anybody voted, you've got to respect democracy, and it never happened.
Regardless of the grand promises that are being offered about council housing going back up to levels not seen since 1948, he isn't ready to throw his weight behind that at the ballot box, which is interesting and probably slightly worrying for, politicians who are hoping that those policies are going to cut through. As someone who is 47 and is father of four and he's had difficulties with his housing, he just has lost trust in the systems.
Did you meet anyone sleeping rough?
Going along to these sort of tents in the daytime, they're not there, they're out and about, they're walking around. So in a couple of the tents, I left notes with my number. And one of the people that called me back was Thomas, who's a Polish guy who'd been out of work just for about a year and very quickly had become homeless. And he was sleeping in a stand of willows.
So Thomas had come here from Poland, presumably looking for opportunity, and is now camping by the banks of a river.
Thomas lived and worked in Peterborough in warehouses and so on steadily for a dozen years. It's a place that's had a large influx of people from the European Union. I think about 16% of the population there now come from other EU countries. And, he fell on hard times and became homeless. So he's like any of the other Peterborians, if you like. He's part of the fabric of the place.
Did immigration come up a lot with people you spoke to in the town?
From time to time, it does. But often, it's not the first thing that people talk about. People are talking about a sense of Peterborough losing its way to some degree, being in stasis or static, not going forward, maybe going backwards slightly.
No, it's static. I think it's static. It's just... Oh, sorry, nearly scored then. Yeah, we're static. There's nothing really happening. I don't know what will change it.
So one of the people I met was A.D. Moles, and he's the chairman of the Peterborough Town Football Club Supporters Association. He was really interesting. He's 60 years old. He's Peterborough through and through. Super proud of his town. We went down to the London Road ground and watched a match together.
I don't think we know where we are. I don't think we've got an identity anymore as a city. I think there's a lot of cities like that. I like the fact, I've lived in Peterborough all my life, and I like the fact, you know, I went away for 12 years in the Air Force, but I always came back. And I like the fact that, you know, a lot of my friends who I went to school with and what have you are from various backgrounds, and whatever they may be doesn't bother me. Most people are like that, but it just sometimes gets too much for some people, of which I possibly could be one of them. It's, you know, when you're walking through the town centre, you almost yearn to hear an English voice and you don't hear one. And it just gets too much sometimes. It just doesn't seem like we've got any identity anymore.
Peterborough has so much potential, and it's not a town that is, you know, at the bottom of any deprivation index. In fact, it's quite high up. It's within striking distance of London on the train, pretty high levels of employment. It's got a beautiful town centre. So there's plenty there and there's plenty of potential, but there is just this intangible sense of things have just been going backwards, been going slightly wrong, and the identity of the place, the sort of what the place means, what it stands for, is something that has been, you know, dissolving or evaporating, and that people find that really frustrating.
Dissolving because of the speed at which immigration, particularly from Eastern Europe, has changed the area.
I think probably that to some degree, but as much people talk about the effects of austerity in different ways. People talk about the fact that there aren't enough police officers to address crimes as they come up. People talk about the, again and again, about the standards of the schools. People are so frustrated that Peterborough schools are kind of at the bottom of league tables. The sense of the sort of fabric of the place just kind of getting a bit crumbly. It's that basic stuff that causes frustration. It's not so much immigration as the kind of primary reason. It's a cocktail of all of those different things coming together, and the loss of places like Thomas Cook.
You know, I remember standing on this road in Peterborough just ahead of the EU referendum, and it felt really multicultural and in many ways thriving. But I met a guy who'd lived there 64 years, and he told me how he had watched the place transform around him and felt quite disorientated by that. And it kind of changed the way I think about immigration, made me think this is about more than economics.
I think you're probably talking about the Lincoln Road, which is, you're quite right, it's just an amazing place, and it's probably one of the most vibrant parts of the city. And what you've just said about people, you know, long-term Peterborians who feel no kind of animosity towards the immigrants, but they do feel a change, is exactly the same thing that I've heard again and again. And one of the things is that along that road, there used to be loads of pubs, and there used to be a pub crawl that people would talk about doing. 12 or 14 pubs along the Lincoln Road. I think there's only one left now. And what's replaced them has been this kind of row of really vibrant cafes. And they go late into the night. There's Portuguese cafes and Afghan cafes. People in Peterborough think they're great. And they love the fact that people have sat outside those cafes and having a great time. And yet, they don't know where their pub crawl's gone. It's that sort of difficulty that they have, that things have just kind of shifted beneath their feet. It's not a resentment. It's just, well, where did my Peterborough go? And it's based in kind of memory, isn't it, of those nights with your friends doing the pub crawl, or of your childhood. Identity is made up of those sorts of things. And that's why politics at the moment is so hard to read, because it seems to be tapping into those kind of deep feelings that people have about, you know, where we are and who we are.
And all of that is really complicated. I think that the issue of immigration leading to the Brexit vote, at least in part, in a place like Peterborough, was the reason that there was so much focus on it as almost a Brexit capital in the UK. And yet in 2017, it booted out a Tory Brexiteer, Stuart Jackson.
Yeah, and now the election is a three-way race between Conservatives, Brexit Party and Labour. And it may well be that Labour come through again if the Brexit Party and the Conservatives split the vote. It's very confusing for voters whether they are pro-Brexit, who to vote for, or if they're Remain, whether they want to vote against the referendum decision and vote Lib Dem, which isn't really an option for them there. So it's a tough choice for the electorate. And I do get the sense that there'll be quite a lot of people who are just going to decide not to vote.
I mean, I was going to ask, is there a sense of frustration and distrust? We've all had a lot of elections in recent years. I mean, two general elections, Europeans, locals, a referendum. Peterborough's also had a by-election. I mean, its former Labour MP, Fiona Onasanya, was convicted over a speeding issue. Constituents voted to boot her out. I mean, did that lead to people just not trusting politicians?
Well, I think that's why the Labour candidate and the Brexit Party candidate now are really pushing their kind of local credentials as people who have lived and grown up and are completely embedded in the city, because it gets away from that. It becomes about, we understand this place. And that is probably the way we end up getting out of this, is having people who represent places who really understand them and then stand up for that. Whether that stuff is credible or people find that credible is another question.
But it also feels like there's a much, much bigger question for a place like Peterborough than who wins an election in 2019. I mean, that Thomas Cook story that you told, that's inextricably linked to the place, is a 40-year story of an area that was cutting edge and optimistic and filled with jobs and a kind of pioneer in house building. I mean, what did you come away with thinking was needed?
I think I came away with the feeling that it's a place absolutely packed with potential. You know, the people there are proud of their place. It's got incredible diversity and it's well placed geographically. They're trying to boost the levels of skills and education. It's all there for the taking, really, in Peterborough. And I suppose there's lots of parts of the country where you could say that. So there's potential, but whether there's hope, given the lack of conviction about the way governments are dealing with things at the moment, is another matter, I think.
Rob, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Rob Booth. Do go to the website and read his latest piece on Peterborough. Coming up, a Turkish journalist on how speaking the truth changed his life forever. Now, Can Dündar is the former editor of Cumhuriyet, a liberal-leaning Turkish newspaper. In May 2015, a video was sent to the paper proving what Can and his team had long suspected, that the Turkish state was illegally sending arms to Islamists fighting in Syria. The video, filmed by the Turkish police, showed the Turkish Gendarmerie security forces searching Turkish intelligence trucks full of weapons. As Can's new play about the incident opens in London, he explains what happened.
The video was taken by the police and showing that some intelligence officers were driving the trucks and stopped by Turkish gendarmerie. And when they were checking it, they found the armory. Very clear that they were trying to get these arms to a neighboring country, which was an international crime. And it was like an adventure movie, but it was real. One may think that it doesn't have an impact on my life, but if you hear news about a bombing in London metro station, you may understand that that's about your life. So if someone is selling arms to these radicals there, that may have consequences in your life as well. So someone should defend the truth to protect you from those dangers. So, of course, I checked the material and the video was real. And, of course, I was considering the consequences, personal and at the same time for my paper. And, of course, the risk was there. That's why I just wanted to ask my colleagues, and all of them supported me in this sense. I decided to publish the story. The next day, I got a call from a colleague saying that the Prime Minister Erdogan is at the moment talking about you on the TV, saying that the journalists who made the story would pay a heavy price for this. I tweeted that night saying that the politician who made this attempt would pay a heavy price for this. But since then, I've been paying the price, really. I mean, because immediately they started the investigation, and after the elections, they ask two life sentences for this true story. And then I was put in jail, spent 3 months in solitary confinement. Then I was released, and of course, there was a kind of assassination attempt against me in Istanbul just after the court decision. Then I was forced to live in exile. I've been working as a journalist for 40 years now, and this is the darkest period of time in my whole professional life. And I'm afraid it's the same for Turkish journalism. Turkey is the biggest jailer for journalists, according to Reporters Without Borders data. We have 150 journalists almost in jail. When you put one journalist in jail, you can silence the others as well. I don't feel any regret about publishing this story because it's part of our job, unfortunately. I mean, it's part of the business as a journalist. This is the price of defending the truth in one corner of the world you may never care of. There are people ready to sacrifice their lives for the truth, to defend the democracy. And it's not only our truth, but this is your truth as well.
Jan's play, #WeAreArrested, follows the story of the release of that video and is on at the Arcola Theatre in London right now. That's it for today. My thanks to Rob Booth and Jan Dundar. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.